welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by OU Israel. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Parshat Shlach. In a way, this is an anniversary parsha for Torah Tidbits, not the Torah Tidbits Audio radio show, but the hard copy started 15 years ago for Erev Shabbat Shlach, and it is no coincidence that the topic of Shlach presents a very pro-Aliyah attitude, which I have expressed once in a while, as does Arut Sheva. Most of the show will be a shiur that I gave a short while ago to the Torah Tibbetz folders after they had finished folding, so you won't hear the sound of their knife blades, which they use to smooth out the creases, clinking on the tables. But I wanted to share those words with them and with you. It's a typical Shlach talk from me, with a few other things thrown in. But first, let us say Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli Tehiyena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor ya Adonai mi ya'amod, ki imacha ha-salicha lema'an tivarei, ki vi ti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro ho-cholti, nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim la-boker, shomerim la-boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya, ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'me'afela la'ora u'mishibud l'gu'ula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Today, this day of recording and first broadcast, is Thursday of Shabbat Parshat Shlach. On the Jewish calendar, it's the 21st day of the month of Sivan. This Shabbat, we will announce Rosh Chodesh, we will bench Rosh Chodesh, Tammuz, which will be next Shabbat and its following day, Sunday. And on the secular calendar, it is the 7th of June. I have a pretty song I would like to share with you. I don't know if I can weave it in to the topics that we will be discussing. I don't even know if we'll have time for a song. That's why I want to play it now, so that I will insist that there be time and have to cut everything else short. But here it is. It's from an album called Shamayim Va'aretz. It's the work of Ovadia Chamema. I don't know if that's how you pronounce the name. And it's different. It's very mystical words. The tefillah called Ana Bechoach, which we say as part of Kabbalat Shabbat. We say it in Korbanot every morning. And it's part of the after passages of Sfirat HaOmer. It is a piece written by Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana. It has a lot of mysticism attached to it, which maybe some other time we'll have a time to share with you. In the meantime, just listen. It's very mellow. Enjoy, and then we'll get into the topic of Parshat Shlach. You'll see everything fits very nicely in Parshat Shlach. When you ask someone who knows the Torah, what's Parshat Shlach, the natural reaction is Chet HaMeraglim. That's a major theme in the Parsha. And it takes up a considerable number of the Psukim in the Parsha. But it's very, very instructive to see what the Torah speaks about right afterwards. And not just right afterwards, but really for the rest of the Sedra. First, let's review. We're talking about God giving reluctant permission. That's a term we'll use for God, even though it's not like that. Reluctant permission to agree
with the people who requested to send scouts ahead of them into Eretz Yisrael. Also know that the purpose of that scouting party was to determine the strategically best way to go into Eretz Yisrael. It was never meant to decide whether to go or not. In fact, that's my way of summarizing the whole problem of the Meraglim. Had they come back and they reported factually about the strength of the cities and the people, and therefore we should check with strategic experts and it would be good to go this way and that way and divide up here and sneak in this way, whatever, fine. But to say it's a place that eats its inhabitants and we shouldn't go there, they were never sent for that, they were never asked their opinion about that, and that's what we call Chet HaMeraglim. It causes one to shiver when you think about how similar things are today, how things haven't changed. People come to visit Israel with the idea, possibly, of determining the best way to come on Aliyah. That's called a pilot trip, like the spying here. Instead, many of them come back and make that same kind of determination. It's a beautiful place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. And worse than a person making that individual decision is the effect that it has on others. Because somehow, the Meraglim were not satisfied to say, we plan on staying here in the Midbar, and the rest of you could do whatever your conscience dictates. It was there influencing and panicking the masses in order to keep them away from Eretz Yisrael. A pilot trip should be not should I go on Aliyah or not. It should be what's the best way to go. Where's the best place to live? Where to live for younger people? What to retrain? Is my degree good here? You know, all of those kind of things, which is what they were sent for. And they came back with a whole negative thing. All right, let's not get into that now because I want to show you how the rest of the Sedra fits in, as I called it so neatly, with this part. The generation is punished. It was the males of that generation, so at least the people sitting here at this table, myself excluded, can hold their heads up high that the women were not the ones to talk disparagingly against Israel, nor were they the ones that panicked and said, you will make us widows. It's the husbands who said, you will turn our wives into widows, and for that they were punished, and our children into orphans. That's what they said. Here. Lama Hashem mevio tanu el haaretz hazot. Why is God bringing us to this land? Linpol bacherev, that we should fall by the sword. Nashenu v'tapenu yiyu lavaz, our wives and children will be alone. Halo tov lanu shuv mitzroima, it's better that we go back to Egypt. That is the ultimate affront to the whole plan. God took us out of Egypt in order to bring us to Eretz Yisrael, and here the people, the leaders of the people, except of course for Kalev, Yeshua, and Aaron, and Moshe, are saying to the people, in essence saying to God, thanks but no thanks, we'd rather go back to Mitzrayim. And there's no way that you could overemphasize the seriousness of this affront. But again, I want you to see now what comes next. God is angry more than he was with Chet HaEgel. Chet HaEgel was an act of idolatry. And it's the commentary say, God can forgive us for that. But the affront to the plan to go into Eretz Yisrael is unforgivable. And it was Moshe's intercession that at least saved the day somewhat. Now, God says to Moshe and Aaron, Ad matai lo ida hara hazot, how much longer to this wicked multitude? Punishment in this wilderness, their bodies will drop, anyone from the age of 20 and up, because of this affront. And their wives will be widows and their children will be left fatherless because of what they did. It's a terrible, terrible thing. The number of days that they toured the land, 40 days, will be matched one day per to 1 year, and it will be 40 years that they will wander. Side point, which is interesting. Chet HaMeraglim, what we're talking about now, occurred more than a year out of Egypt. The total amount of time between the Exodus and entry into Eretz Yisrael was a little tiny bit less than 40 years. So here we're talking about a decree not to wander and die out over the next 40 years, but to die out in a period that will end up being a total of 40 years, retroactive to the year before. And what you could say is that God did not see Chet HaMeraglim as a single affront. He says specifically, this is the 10th time that these people have irked me. I don't know if irked is the right word, but the 10th time, and I see this punishment as including all 10 of those affronts. So even though we speak of the punishment for the sin of the spies being dying out in a period of 40 years, it really was less than 39 years left to the sentence, so to speak. Okay, there are Mefarshim that will list the 10, and there's probably more. 10 is like a choice round number. There's a brief episode here of the people sincerely regretting the affront and saying, okay, let's go. By that time, it was too late. And Moshe said, don't go, because going is not a matter of when you decide. It's a matter of when God tells you to go and that he'll be with you. And the people didn't listen, compounding the sin. Okay, let's leave that for a moment, but not quite. Yeah. All right. You know, if you're bringing that issue up, it's a different story. If a person says, I honestly believe that one has to wait to be led to Eretz Yisrael by the Mashiach, and therefore I will not go until Mashiach comes, A, I say he's wrong. B, it makes sense that he should wait. In other words, I would love to convince everyone who says that they're wrong, that God never intended us not to go when we're able to go. This is a very important concept in Judaism called hishtadlus. Hishtadlus means human effort to be matched by the grace of God and not just sitting back and waiting to be carried on the proverbial wings of eagles. But there's an argument. You want to be more pointed. There is a notion of the three famous oaths that were imposed on Bnei Israel when they went into Galut, into exile, one of which was that they would not mass together in their countries of exile and forcibly take over Eretz Yisrael from the occupiers, to use a term that is turned back on us. But that oath, even if it exists, and there's a whole question as to whether there's a halachic significance to it or it's just a midrashic kind of tradition which has different ways of interpreting, but assuming that that's the case, then it is well established, at least by religious Zionist leaders, that that oath was abrogated as a result of the United Nations vote in November 1947, giving permission to the Jewish people to establish a Jewish homeland in Palestine. In other words, there, any Jews that decided to take the world at its word and say, okay, they give me permission for a homeland, I therefore am not bound by any kind of oath not to mass together in order to go and take it over forcefully. I'm going with the world's permission. More than that, individuals were never prevented by halacha, by any sense, not to go back to Eretz Yisrael. If anything, it was the Jewish nation was said, you're in Galut now, and this is where you have to stay as a mass until the time will come. So the argument at least goes both ways, with the as I said, the religious Zionist approach being that the permission was granted by the world, and by the way, permission that they cannot take back, even if there were to be a United Nations resolution today, saying we gave permission in 1947, but we changed our minds and you no longer could go, that's too bad. We consider the oath to have already been abrogated by their permission. Plus, it gets a little bit more complicated, the fact that one of the oaths was not upon us, but it was on the rest of the nations of the world not to overly oppress us in our places of exile, which they certainly did not keep to throughout Jewish history. And that alone can say they didn't keep that side of the bargain, we don't have to keep our side of the bargain, and we're back here. Again, you've got Satmar, the Ture Karta, which are aligned, who have that approach that the claiming of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel before directed to by Melech HaMashiach is illegal, unacceptable, is against what God wants. They are a minority, a small minority. The average Jew accepts the notion that Jews who want to can come back, and once they are here, they can develop any kind of infrastructure for their best possible survival, and that includes a defensive army, and it includes government, and all of what we have here. Not that it always works the way it should work, but it's there, and there's permission to come. But, you know, in context with this, you know, without putting labels on it, which are difficult to do, there are some Jews who live in Chutz Laaretz who have good reasons why they can't now pick themselves up and come live in Israel. And personally, I have no complaint against such people. I have sympathy towards them. I would like to do what I can to make it easier. But there are problems. Elderly parents, divided families, parnassa issues, and many other things. So, not talking about it, I'm not criticizing those people. My target are the Jews in Chutz Laaretz who say, Aliyah? What are you, out of your mind? Now, I don't know about you, but I was told that when I told someone I was coming in Aliyah, one of the leaders of the religious Zionists of America, one of the leaders, I thought he'd be so happy for me. I said, what are you, out of your mind? That was his reaction.
Hold that thought. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio on either OU Radio or Israel National Radio. We're into the show for Parshat Shlach, and let's pick up a shiur to the folders in progress on a very serious topic from this week's Sedra.
When a leader of the Jewish people can come back and say, God took us out of Egypt to turn our wives into widows and our children into orphans, and it's better that we should go back to Mitzrayim, is terrible. And to say it is far better to stay in Jewish communities in different places in the world than to go on Aliyah is folly that is perpetuating Chet HaMeraglim. More, I used to think it was the Rambam, but I then found out that it was the Rambam quoting the Gemara. The Gemara, which nobody argues against, says clearly, La'olam yadur adam be'eretz Yisrael, a person should always choose to live in Israel, afilu be'ir sherubo ovdei kochavim umazalot, even in a city where the majority of the population are idol worshippers. Va'al yadur Adam bechutz la'aretz, and a person should not live in chutz la'aretz, afilu be'ir sherubo Yisrael, or something like that. Even in a city where the majority of Jews are Jews. So when you say, look at Borough Park, and look at Muncie, and look at Teaneck, and look at Five Towns, and look at all of these great Jewish communities, they're fine. They're fine. But they have locked themselves into a certain mentality that borders, at least unintentionally, if not intentionally, Chet HaMeraglim. I'll tell you another thing in this respect. The success of the Jews throughout history in not only surviving exile, but in thriving in exile is much, much to our credit, with God's help, of course. Because any people with stuff less tough than Judaism would have given up a long time before. But when you are in a situation where we will have to make do the best we can with what we have, and you do well, that works only when you can't, or when it is extremely difficult to do something about it. Every year that passes, Aliyah becomes easier and easier. Nefesh B'Nefesh is the most recent example. You know, people say, I came on Aliyah before Nefesh B'Nefesh, you know, B'Nefesh. So, you know, that's like a sign, a badge of, I was a pioneer. I had to walk through the mud, you know, and Nefesh B'Nefesh, they put down carpeting wherever there's mud for the people to walk on. So next year it'll be something else, or 2 years, or 10 years down the line. But it's certainly the fact that I was able to get on a plane, and that the Jewish agency picked up the tab for my flight. It had a condition. If I did not stay in Israel for a certain number of years, I would owe them the money for the flight. But they paid for me to come, technically. And they took me on a taxi ride from the airport to my apartment, and all the other benefits that you have. So it loses a little bit of the punch when people said, look at how well we did under these conditions of exile. Yes, to the credit of the community at the time. But you got to tap them on the shoulder and say, reality check. It is no longer something that you boast when Eretz Yisrael was a wasteland, and when Eretz Yisrael didn't have yeshivot, and it didn't have the ability to absorb people, and the British put a quota on us, and the Turks did this. Fine. That's when you could pat yourself on the back about the wonderful community that you developed. But when you've got more Torah institutions and Torah learning and people learning Torah in Eretz Yisrael than anywhere in the world ever in the history of the Jewish people since Sinai. I was going to say, not since Sinai, but even including Sinai. You know, Sinai was 600,000 men and women and children, total 2 million people hearing the words of the Torah. I wonder if we're getting there, whatever. I don't mean to play the number game, as well as to make the point. And that's still not what I want to show you. But I get passionate about this issue to just bring in my father, Zichrono Livracha. I remember every year when we read Parshat Shlach, he would really get agitated about... He said to me many times, but even as a kid, I wonder how people who are not thinking about Aliyah read or hear Parshat Shlach without getting upset, without getting nervous, without feeling as if the Torah is talking about them. I often wonder, in other parts also, if there is a person who desecrates the Shabbat and learns Torah. There are people like that. There were, especially. And they're probably still today. There was an article about this. Chiloni Yeshiva, yeah. So, what do they do when they get up to Zachor at Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho and Lo Ta'aseh Kol Melacha? Do they feel a tiny bit guilty? I don't know. But I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about otherwise religious people who keep Shabbos meticulously, keep Kashrut meticulously, go out of their way not only to do it regular, but to do it Mahadrin and all of that, Mahadrin, Minha Mahadrin. And when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, it's like, you know, what, me? You know, who? You know, why? And worse, I think the worst is when they say, you are crazy for coming. Were you ever told you were crazy for coming? Yeah. Was anyone here not told that?
someone, in one of the shade room I heard this week, someone was giving excuses. And one person said, I can't stay here. There's no white album cartoonist. So the voice was cracked up with laughter. But
and a person was serious?
If you're looking for an excuse, if it's not the tuna fish...
You should know they have white albacore tuna also. In olive oil, no less. In olive oil. It's very expensive. The regular tuna is fine. In fact, the regular tuna starkist that we have has a higher kashrut standard than any tuna in the United States of the OU. And here's the OU on this tuna that says that red and yellow label has a higher standard of kashrut. Anyway, forget that. What I want to show you now is the following. After the episode of Chet HaMeraglim, the Torah continues. Now, you know that many, many times commentaries say, what's the connection of this with this? Sometimes the answer is simple. This happened after this happened, so when do you want me to tell you about it? But here, it's a very important question, and you'll see why. God says to Moshe, saying, speak to the people of Israel and tell them, when you come to the land that I am giving you, and you will bring sacrifices, either required sacrifices or voluntary sacrifices, or during your holidays, you will bring with them, with the animal sacrifices, mincha, solet, isaron, balul, berviat, hahin, shemen. You will bring fine flour mixed with oil as what's known as a mincha, a gift offering, minachot is the plural, v'yayin lanesech, revi'etahin, and wine of libation to pour on the mizbeach, a quarter of a hin, it's a certain liquid measure, ta'aseh al ha'ola o halazavech lakeves ha'echad, for each a lamb gets one revi'et of a hin. For an ayal, which is an adult sheep, a ram, this is the amount, and for a par, an ox, a bull, this is the amount. And it continues a whole portion about minachot and nisachim. You look in Sefer Achinuch, the counting of the mitzvot, Parshat Shlach, and you sort of flip back, flip forward, say, where is this mitzvah of bringing minachot and doing yayin nesach? It's not here. It's elsewhere. Sure enough, you look in the Chumash and you'll find two or three other places that have these exact rules. Now the question is very sharp. What is it doing here? What is it doing here when we don't even learn it for the first time here, where we don't need this portion of 16 verses about Menachot and Nesach? We don't need it at all because it's been there, did it, it's elsewhere. The answer, I think, is obvious. It's here because God has just devastated the people with the harshest decree possible. Yes, I took you out of Egypt, but you, meaning the adult male population, will continue wandering about this midbar, and you will drop dead here. As harsh as that sounds, which is why I said it like that. And you will not go into this land that I swore to your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, your patriarchs and matriarchs, that you will come. Your children will. And that's this. This is a comfort, at least if the parents can't benefit from it, to be told immediately, rather than being devastated, that we, each year when we read through the Torah and we reread the account of the Meraglim, we should see this very next thing God is saying, yes, I still love you. You know, when a child is disciplined, if the punishment is very harsh, there's a question that the child has, which sometimes he asks and sometimes he's afraid to ask. Because he knows that he did wrong, and he knows he's being punished, and he would like to say to his father or to his mother, do you still love me? And the parent should say, even without being asked, yes, I still love you, but you did a terrible thing and you're being punished. And that's what this is. Because it's not your run-of-the-mill mitzvah that has to do with Eretz Yisrael. We're talking about Beit HaMikdash, which is B'nai Yisrael at its best. We're talking about the part of Korbanot that accompanied the regular sacrifices, which are considered to be Reach Nichoach Lashem. Reach Nichoach Lashem means a pleasing fragrance to God. Not that God needs the pleasing fragrance, but the concept is would be the same in my analogy of a child who's being punished. Do you still love me? Yes. Well, I have a gift for you. Will you accept it? That's something else. You know, I love you. You did bad thing. You're being punished. I don't know if I'm ready to accept this cute card that you drew in kindergarten, you know, with the flowers and you put the glue and the sprinkles on it and sparkles and everything like that. That's not the mood. So when God could follow Chet HaMeraglim with the very next command, is that mitzvah which requires Eretz Yisrael, which requires the Beit HaMikdash, and which is considered a pleasing offering before God, that's a very comforting thing, especially since it doesn't belong here. Especially since if this were not here, we wouldn't miss it because it's elsewhere, where it is in its proper place. Then, again, more. And this one is counted from here. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, Bevoachem el haaretz, when you come into the land, that I am bringing you to there, meaning, you're still bringing us there. We thought maybe differently. Don't worry, we're still bringing you there. When you eat from the fruit of the ground, from the bread of the ground, tarimu terumah lashem, you will give a gift from it to God. What? Reshit arisotechem chala tarimu terumah, you will give chala. Chala is one of the 24 gifts of the kahuna, but chala is really something extra special. Think about it for a minute. Here's a farmer and he grows wheat. He grows the wheat, he plants the wheat, he plows his field, he plants the wheat, he cultivates the growth, he harvests the crop, and he gives a roughly 2% of the produce, he separates it and designates it for a kohen, teruma. He then takes 1/10 of that which remains and designates it as ma'aser rishon, to be given to a Levi or Levium of his choice. He then has to take a second tithe of what's left, which either in some years he keeps but brings to Yerushalayim and eats it here, or he redeems it and spends the money in Yerushalayim on food and drink, or it's given to poor people. After all of that, isn't that enough to give? One more gift. One more gift. When you finish taking all of the tithing, the truma, the maser rishon, the maser sheni, maser ani, and you now take what's left of your wheat that you worked for all of these months, and you bring it to the mill, and you grind it into flour, and then you take the flour, and you mix it with water and yeast and other ingredients and make a dough. One more gift. When you are finished with the dough, before you bake it, take a portion of that dough, 1/24 quantity in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, take 1/24 of that dough and give it to a Kohen or Kohanim of your choice. They now have a dough ready-made. Remember, I don't know if they still have it, Kinneret put out these frozen, ready-to-bake challahs. They did all the work for you. Yes, they did all the work for you, and you had to take it home, thaw it, let it rise for 2 hours, smear some egg and sprinkle poppy seeds on it, put it in the oven. That's what challah is to a kohen. At the time of the Beit HaMikdash, he not only got a sack or a bushel of flour of wheat from people, but from certain people who he knew, his relatives, whatever, friends, neighbors, he got a gift of a dough ready to bake. That's the gift of challah. Challah is one of the many mitzvot that bring bread to our table. In other words, the bread that you are making chamotzi on, that you are finally going to eat, has already been properly trumad and misered and chalad and all the other things that have to do it. And you washed for hamotzi. And you made hamotzi. And now finally you can eat it. Challah is like the everyday continuation of the mun. The mun, the manna, was lechem min hashamayim, bread that fell from the heavens. It was a 40-year miracle, never to be had again. And instead, we don't have now food from some other source than God. It is still food from God, but with a greater human involvement, because we're the ones that plant the grain, and we're the ones that harvest it, cultivate it and harvest it, and we are the ones that do all of these things. So it becomes a partnership. It's like the difference between infancy, or even if you want to say pregnancy, where the mother nourishes the unborn all by herself. Whatever she eats gets fed to him in the tubes and stuff like that, and he does not go out and eat on his own. He doesn't go to the store to buy. But as a child grows, especially into adolescence and adulthood, he begins more and more to take care of his own needs, but never losing sight of the fact that ultimately it comes from God as well. Any more than it was obvious that the mun came from God has to be that the bread that you eat every day also has to be acknowledged that it comes from God, and we do acknowledge it. When you say, blessed are you, God, our God, King of the universe, who takes bread from the ground, we are making a statement every time we eat bread that it was not only our ancestors who ate the mun who acknowledged that it came from God, but it's every day that we acknowledge the same. And if you eat bread without making a bracha and without washing, it's like denying that this comes from, what do you mean from God? I bought it at the makolet. You know, that's a very narrow view of it.
The first time that I ever heard anybody mention when we do lahafish challah, because we always like burn it when we're baking challah, we let that burn.
I said in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. No, the problem today with challah, see, challah is interesting. Challah officially applies only in Eretz Yisrael and only at the time of the Beit HaMikdash. Yet Chazal said, keep going, keep doing it. Not only keep doing it even when there's no Beit HaMikdash, even when you're in Chutz La'aretz. Now the Torah clearly says, Bivoachem El Ha'aretz, when you come to the land. That's a key phrase, like several others like it, that says, mitzvah that has to do in Eretz Yisrael. Come the Chachamim and they say, we want you to do it everywhere so that Torah Challah, that's what it's called, the teaching of Challah, shall not be lost from Israel. By the way, this is another significance of the two mitzvot that are counted from Parshat Shlach, because in both cases, the rabbis were sensitive to the lesson being applicable way after the mitzvah itself is suspended. And they said, we're not going to suspend this mitzvah. We want you to go out of your way to do this mitzvah, even though you cannot give it to a Kohen now. Why not? Because the person who's baking the challah, making the dough, has to be tahor. The flour from which it's being baked has to be tahor. The Kohen who's going to eat it has to be tahor. Otherwise it's forbidden because it's sacred food. And therefore we take not a 24th portion, but a token amount, and we toss it in the oven and we burn it there, just so as not to forget challah. But in real times, it will be Peril and her husband, or Peril's husband and her, who will receive the challah She will thank us. We will probably bring it. We'll probably bring our dough for convenience on a Wednesday or a Thursday when there's folding Torah tidbits anyway. And we know that Peril will be here. And will come. She'll have a special Tupperware container because she knows she'll be getting challah from you.
Teach your daughters not to look to marry a doctor or lawyer, to marry a Kohen.
Okay, there are restrictions that they suffer also, so let's not get into that. But the point is that in addition to minachot, which is interesting because mincha in the Beit HaMikdash is a flour bread or cracker or wafer or matzah that's in the context of the Beit HaMikdash followed immediately by you at your own table. That's one of the beauties of Judaism to me. When Judaism is not only in the temple, only in the synagogue, but it's in your home. And here the 1-2 punch is very obvious. Mereshit arisotechem titnu truma lashem lidorotechem, in perpetuity.
We'll stop the shiur there. There is more, and perhaps on the OU radio version and on the archived Rusheva version, it will have the full shiur, but I hope I made a point. There's a lot to be said, and I try to say it in different ways. So, with that, let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom. Lehishtamea.
Thank you. Goodbye now. Goodbye. Goodbye. Thank you. Goodbye.
But if you're still here, there is more. Stay tuned.
Now watch what else you have here. You have another portion, or two, which is taught elsewhere, which is not counted here, which really has no place here, but it's got to be therefore obvious what it's doing here. If it'll turn out that people will sin as a community, misled by their leaders, tell me, isn't it obvious what the Torah is talking about by putting this in Parshat Shlach following Chaita Meraglim? Because Meraglim were 10 individuals who came back and panicked the entire multitude of people. Just like leaders of a Sanhedrin could inadvertently, and here I don't think it's the right word for what they did it on purpose, but here we're talking about V'chi Tishgu, Shogeg. Maybe they'll make a mistake and violate one of the many mitzvot of the Torah. Here they're talking specifically about capital offense. V'hoya im me'enei ha'edan estalish gaga, v'yasu chol ha'eda. The punishment is a sacrifice that is brought on behalf of the entire community. Let's give a tachlis example. If a Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court of Israel, were to, and you know that the Sanhedrin was partially judiciary, but a major portion of its function was legislative. They were the ones who paskined halacha. Let's take as an example a Shabbos issue. A Sanhedrin issues a heter, a permission, not more than a heter. They say it is mutar, permission to do such and such. Don't even push me to get an example what such and such is, but they did it. Let's say to use electric lights on Shabbos, to turn them on and off. If they were to say that, and then admit that they made a mistake, 2 months later, official notice from the Sanhedrin, we were in error when we gave permission for people to use electric lights on Shabbat. It is really Osra min HaTorah to so do. Each individual who followed the Sanhedrin by using electric lights on Shabbat with what he thought was permission, because after all, the Sanhedrin is the authoritative body of halacha. When we say Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah, for out of Zion shall come Torah, Udvar Hashem and the Yerushalayim, and the word of God from Jerusalem, we mean the Sanhedrin. When they say something, it's Torah. They admit they made a mistake. Everybody that had in the last X number of Shabbatot turned on and off electric lights based on the Sanhedrin is not required to bring a korban chatat. A korban chatat, a sin offering, is when something is forbidden and you inadvertently violate it. Not when you were told by the Sanhedrin it was permitted. The Sanhedrin, on behalf of the entire population, has to bring a korban called par he'elam davar shel tzibur, a bull, ben bakar, as an ola, and a se'ir izim for chatat, because of the shogeg which they foisted on the people by making an erroneous psak. And if my example is not perfect, then you'll have to fit it with another example, but it will be a working example for the time being. However, the Torah continues by saying, but when it's an individual that sins, then he's responsible for his own action. Whoa. Here you have the Meraglim. Do we say the entire population that panicked by the words of the Meraglim should be off the hook from any kind of punishment because they were misled by their leaders? It's a factor, but it doesn't hold well here, because you had Kalev and Yehoshua, 2 out of the 12, and Moshe Rabbeinu, the ultimate teacher of Torah, who were saying, this is wrong what they're saying. This is not what we're supposed to do. So it's very difficult. It would be like a Sanhedrin saying something, and a Rav says, you know, they're wrong. I don't know how to say this, but they made a mistake. And he's not allowed to go ahead and do what they said, if he knows that they made a mistake. So I'm not now judging anybody here, but a person has to be honest with himself. Did you do this because, well, everybody was doing it, and because I assumed it was okay because everybody was doing it? Or did you know in your heart that it was the wrong thing to do? Then you might have trouble preaching that against the Sanhedrin, but you certainly don't have a problem of not doing the wrong thing. It's somewhere in between, and the Torah provides for both. The Torah provides a sin for the community, a sin offering for the community when it's the leader's fault, and a sin offering for an individual when he can't blame anyone other than himself. And which it is, that's a technical question, and you have to ask the Shaila. When there's a Beit HaMikdash, we have korbanot that we're going to be obligated to do. For years, I was doing X, Y, or Z on Shabbat. Now I find out it's not allowed to be done. Do I have to bring a korban chatat for that? Or was I misled by the conventional wisdom of my time, which said it's okay to do, even though I find out that it's not okay? Or what? Or whatever. But that's all here. So that's what I meant by the Seder being neat. You have the episode of the spies, and those lessons are unto themselves what we learn from them. And then you have the rest of the Seder, which says, okay, does not say, let's forget about Chet HaMeraglim and talk about some other things. No, every single thing the Torah presents is about Chet HaMeraglim, or has a background of Chet HaMeraglim. And the way that we approach, how we punish our children, there are lessons there. How we are responsible for our own selves. And by the way, on the note of, well, I didn't do this because the Gedolim didn't do this. I still remember this friend, which is why I called the lead tidbit this week, and people still smoke. Had a friend years ago, big smoker, frum guy. He said, when Reb Moshe Feinstein says it's usur, I will stop immediately. Meaning, and he said it, since Reb Moshe Feinstein didn't say that you're not allowed to smoke, it obviously is not forbidden. And if you tell this to Reb Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law, Rabbi Moshe Tendler, he gets very agitated because he says his father-in-law was opposed to smoking in halacha, but it wasn't yet the time to make the fuss about it that Rabbanim in our time are making. And even to this day, you've got wise guy yeshiva kids who are smoking, and it tears your heart out to see them.
Yes.
You know, I had this experience years ago before I came in Aliyah. I went into one of the stores in Mea Shearim to buy strings for my talis. I wanted to tie my own tzitzis, which fits into this week's Sedra, so I can talk about it. And the guy tried to convince me to go for the more expensive strings, which are hand-spun by men, rather than hand-spun by women or machine-spun. Because spinning of the strings has to be L'shem Mitzvah, which could be done by machine also if the person operating it does L'shem Mitzvah, but forget that. Okay. So I said to him, you know, I would feel much more confident in your recommendation of this higher category of strings if it weren't for the fact that you're smoking. He says, what do you mean? So I started. He says, stop. In my mind, in my brain, I know that you are right what you're saying.
But I am.
My heart sees my Zadie. My Zadie was the model to him of what a Jew should be. And the picture of his Zadie in his mind included a cigarette. I said, yeah, but in his time, he said, no, you're going to tell me a logical thing. I know the logic. I agree with the logic. My heart won't let me condemn my Zadie that he could have done a wrong thing, and therefore I still smoke. Now, I don't know if that's a good argument or not. Doesn't sound like a good argument to me, but I know what he's talking about. Not everybody is like that. But and the same thing goes for Eretz Yisrael. If the Gedolim thought it was such a big, important mitzvah to live here, why are they there? Why did, you know, and I'm talking about Rav Moshe Feinstein, because he's from my time and your time, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Soloveitchik, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who for a big chunk of my life in the States were the top three Gedolim in the United States. And I had always felt, had they each or all gone on Aliyah, we would have a lot more religious Jews living in Israel. I know, look, as much as I like Rabbi Riskin and Rabbi Gold, I can't compare them with Rav Moshe Feinstein, or Lubavitcher Rebbe, and Rav Soloveitchik. But they are definitely be complimented on the fact that they had a fantastic, legitimate excuse for staying where they were. Look at what they did with their communities. And each of them in their own way said, enough, Ad Kan, I'm coming here. That's why I look up to a guy named like Arla Adler, same thing. And that's why I'm glad, and Rabbi Leff, same thing. Because these are people who could have had an excuse.
And Barrel Wine too.
You could keep naming them, and we got a lot of them. But there are unfortunately a lot who didn't. I heard a shear by somebody in the States talking about Aliyah, where basically he said, a little bit humorously, but also seriously, he says, looking around this room and talking about Aliyah, I would say the person with the best, most legitimate excuse for not going in Aliyah is me. What about the rest of you? And I did not like that at all. That's not what you say. You don't say, I'll stay here and keep tending the flocks. You go. And I'll tell you something else. Any American rabbi that comes here who's got the charisma, can make a name for himself here also, can find his niche, and can continue. I don't think that Rabbi Gold or Rabbi Riskin have, or Rabbi Wine or Rabbi Adler, any of those, have vegetated when they came here. They didn't come and retire to, do their own thing and not be involved with the community. Every single one is heavily involved with the community. And call a kavod. Anyway, that's the story.
So I have a question.
You do?
Yeah. Because now you're just saying about if the Sanhedrin say mislead the people for a time, about the electric light, So now, the question is, why Hashem punished the whole generation?
Because it's not that simple. Because, using that analogy, if many people among the population with their learning and knowledge are convinced that the Sanhedrin made a mistake, it does not give them permission to blindly follow what they said just and do it. They do have a restriction of poskening for other people against the Sanhedrin. That's tricky. But certainly
so,
here...
So the majority were not really arguing with these 10 leaders.
If Kalev gets up at the microphone after the 10 Meraglim did their thing, and he takes the microphone and says, don't listen to them. God says we can do it and we will be able to. He didn't take us out of Egypt to do any harm to us. If he says to go into Eretz Israel, we will be able to prevail there. We just have to do it and listen. The people there had... this was not talking the same thing. You're not talking about a unanimous decision where Moshe Rabbeinu and the Meraglim and the Sanhedrin all say one thing and everybody, you know... So, you know, on the one hand, there's a little bit of an excuse, but my rabbi said it was okay. On the other hand, yeah, but you know that your rabbi was only one of many, and the other said you shouldn't do it, and you were hiding behind, my rabbi said. You know, there are times when you could do that. You know, when you're talking about opening up a soda bottle on Shabbos as to whether you tear the perforation of the cap or not, so one person said, I asked my rav, he said it's okay to do it on Shabbos, so I do it on Shabbos. Another guy will say, well, I asked my rabbi, he said, I can't do it, so I opened my bottles up before Shabbos. Big deal. Big deal. You're not talking about listening to God and going into Eretz Yisrael. We're not going to whitewash that generation. On the other hand, the Meraglim were struck dead immediately. The other people continued to live. I can't exactly call it happily ever after, but... You know, it wasn't the same kind of thing. Same thing with Cheto Egel. Cheto Egel, the 3,000 men who reveled in the Egel, whatever that means, were smitten on the spot. And the people were punished, but not in that same kind of level. There's a difference. You were a leader, and this is how you failed. And you were a follower, and this is what you should have done. The punishment is not the same. It's not on the same level of violation.
If I push a point, so it is a tremendous tragedy what's record here. So today we are entering to Israel. I mean, today we are... Are we also doing the day two of 40 years?
Look, the problem is known as preaching to the converted, meaning that when I talk to people who live in Israel about Aliyah and a positive attitude towards living in Israel, so I'm giving chizuk. Strengthening. You should walk out of here saying, you know, all those years ago I made a decision. It was a good decision. I'm glad I'm here. And you need that too. I don't think it's a different story because I speak the same way in the States on occasion when I have. The last time that happened was at a bar mitzvah of a cousin of mine where he asked me to speak. I said, can I say anything I want? Thinking he would say, just keep away from, you know, the Aliyah topic. He said, no, say anything you want. So I spoke on Friday night and I gave it to him. All right. Nobody spoke to me the rest of Shabbos. My cousins did. But not one person could look me in the eye. Certainly not be friendly. Except one couple. Except one couple, and I was very impressed till they told me they have their tickets already. And they'll be going on Aliyah the following month. And they enjoyed what I said, you know. But that was it. All the rest were quite... And I get people occasionally who will say, I read Torah tidbits. What are you always talking about? Aliyah, living in Israel, keep talking and talking about it. Can't you talk about something else?
What?
No, so I do, you know. I hope I do, but you know, to him, I was blowing it out of proportion. Israel, living in Israel is only one mitzvah out of all of the mitzvot, which it's not. That's the thing. It's the mitzvah that glues the whole thing together. God says, here's the Torah, take it and live in Eretz Israel and be a Jew there. That's what he said. Didn't work out that way. So Baruch Hashem, we're coming back. more and more as we go along. Some of us teach about it, others about us joke about it. Right, David?
But some people are living here and still talk Lashon Hara about it.
Are you David Kalimnik?
That's David Kalimnik, the guy that encourages more people
to stay away from
to stay away from the Israel Center.
I don't know. No. Both incorrect
statements. I thought to look for a wife.
That too. But he has the Aliyah monologues. The answer, Orachedva, is yes, there are people who speak Lashon Hara even here.
Yes.
And there are people...
As if they are not in here.
Huh?
I mean, if they are talking Lashon Hara here, it is as if they are not yet arrived.
I don't want to say what it's as if. What it is speaking Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael, which I think we have ample demonstration is not a proper thing to do. Anybody that... Look, you're not supposed to be dishonest when you're talking to someone. Cousin of yours comes, a former neighbor, a friend, and says, no, so tell me, how is it living here? To say, realistically, you have to be honest. You have to say that transactions in the bank take you 2 to 3 times longer than they did there, although I'm not so sure about that. Apropos that, I still remember when I wrote, got into in Jerusalem, the letters to the editor. There was a series, week after week, of complaints about Israel, Israel, Israel. So I wrote a letter and it started like this. I know exactly what these people mean. I was in the post office. There were two windows. One of them had a sign saying closed. The clerk of that window was smoking a cigarette, drinking a cup of coffee, and talking and distracting the clerk at the other line. People were lined up out into the street. And it was very annoying. People were grumbling. That's the first paragraph. And people, when they read it, said, I was saying, yeah, yeah. Second paragraph, this happened to me on Metropolitan Avenue in Queens, New York. And it's totally the truth. That's exactly where it happened. I said, you want to complain about post office workers who are inconsiderate to customers? Fine. That is not an Israel problem. That's a postal worker problem. There are some very nice postal workers also. But there are some that are arrogant and selfish, and that happens anywhere. You want to talk about a bad bus driver? Fine. You want to say that it has to do with Israel? Wrong, because it doesn't have to do with Israel. I can give you at least one-to-one, if not more, wonderful, wonderful stories of bus drivers that I don't think you could match from elsewhere, when the negative stories will happen all over. A gruff guy is a gruff guy. And a guy that's been driving a bus back and forth on the same route for every day, for 10 hours a day, is going to be gruff. The ones who smile, the ones who go out of your way, the ones that I've seen stop a bus coming in the opposite direction, saying, take this passenger on without him paying, without her paying, because she got on my bus by mistake. Didn't have to do that. He could say, you're going in the wrong direction, let her out at the next stop, and let her fend. But he got her onto another bus. My favorite story with that is... I'll even tell you who it is. Rav Arya Kaplan, Zichrono Livracha, his wife and children were here. And I know the oldest brother, Yossi, he was on a bus, on a crowded bus on a Motzoi Shabbat with his little brother, Chaim. At the time, little kid, 5 years old maybe. So crowded, they were separated. Chaim, unknown to his brother, had fallen asleep on a chair. And as Yossi's about to get off the bus, he goes, Chaim, let's go, we're getting off here. He gets off, the door's closed, the bus drives away. Chaim is not there. So he goes home, tells his mother, they start looking around, they go to the next stop, they call to the terminal, this, that. They're frantic, they got neighbors, they're helping them scour the neighborhood, and they're about to call the police. They go back, days before cell phones, so they go back to their apartment to call the police, and there, sitting on the steps, is Chaim and the bus driver. Bus driver discovered him at the end of the route. It was his last bus of Motzoi Shabbat. He took him to his home, and he was sitting there waiting till his mother came home. Maybe it happens in other countries too. I would like to know that that's good human nature any place. But to me, that's Israel. If you have an attitude that the beautiful things that happen here are to the credit of this country and its people, and the negative things you chalk up to the inconsiderateness of individuals, and you don't attribute it to the country, then we come out okay. The only thing you could blame, well, let's not talk about the leaders of the country, but that's another story. But, you know, same thing. I've had great taxi, I'll give you a negative one. I had a taxi driver who said, 30 shekel. I said, put on the Monet. He said, no, 30 shekel. I said, no, put on the Monet. I'm entitled to getting the meter. No, you don't want to pay 30 shekel, get out. So I got out and I left the back door open. And I started walking away. He calls out, close the door. Just kept walking. He got out and he grumbled and he cursed and everything like that. But he had to come around and close the door. That was my little, you know, instead of taking his number and complaining about it. My sister-in-law actually complained about a taxi driver once, and he was disciplined. She found out because, for some reason, he was able to find out her address, and he ended up begging her to call the company. She was horrified that they revealed her her number or name or whatever. But I don't know how it ended. But there are some great taxi stories of money that was left in, and it's fully intact and.
I guess that's it. I sort of got carried away when I was speaking to the people. Interesting. Thursday, I have deliveries of Torah Tibbetz to make in the morning, and then I come to the center kind of midday. And once in a while, the folding is finished by the time I get down to speak to the folders. And sometimes it's not, then I give them a shear. Once in a while, I'll get there at the end of the folding, start giving a shear or a mini shear, Dvar Torah or whatever, and then continue even beyond when they finish folding and they all stay and listen. Today I got down there after everyone was finished, but they were still milling around schmoozing, and somebody said, I didn't even offer, somebody said, if you give us a shear, we'll stay. So we had that, and I sort of got carried away, and it went for over an hour. I edited out a few things that happened in the middle. But you definitely got more than the gist of it. So let's finish with a song, and again a wish of a Shabbat Shalom.
been a little slice of heaven, because it hasn't.